listening to KBOO Port. KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee will meet on the third Monday of each month at 5:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio during this special programming campaign, All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 2. This February and March, you will hear different marathons and series, all brought to you by our talented programmers, including specials like Black History and Future series. If you'd like to help KBOO reach our $17,000 goal by March 25th, go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321 right now. We thank you, and you're welcome.
This is Rising Up with Sona Ali, a weekly news and analysis program focused on economic, racial, gender justice, and more. I'm your host, Sona Ali Kolhatkar, and you can find us online at risingupwithsonali.com. This week, we'll mark Equal Pay Day, March 14th, with Michelle Kilpatrick, co-director of advocacy and mobilization at the Center for Popular Democracy. Michelle will discuss the solutions that CPD is pushing to close the gender and racial wage gap. Then Yvette Allais, executive director of La Defensa, will join us to discuss how their organization is leading the movement for judicial accountability in addressing pre-trial injustice. Finally, David Delmar Centies, founder of Resilient Coders, joins me to explore his new book, What We Build with Power, The Fight for Economic Justice in Tech. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Rising Up with Sona Ali, and I'm your host, Sona Ali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. March 14th marks Equal Pay Day, the day that indicates how far into the year women must work in order to reach pay parity with their male counterparts from the previous year. Although there's been progress on some aspects of women's rights over the decades, the pay gap between men and women has stubbornly persisted. On average, women who are employed full-time earn only 84% of their male peers. The pay gap increases for women of color, with Black women earning 67% and Latina and Indigenous women earning 57% of what men earn. My guest is Michelle Kilpatrick, co-director of advocacy and mobilization at the Center for Popular Democracy. Welcome to the program, Michelle.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So equal pay day is something that unfortunately still hasn't necessarily entered the mainstream discourse, but it's important for you and your organization. Why exactly? Why is this an important thing to highlight?
Well, it's important to note how much farther we have to go in terms of making sure that we have equality regardless of gender in the workplace. And so, as you just stated, we talk about March 14th as Equal Pay Day, but that really applies primarily to white women. For Black women, it's not until September. For Latina women, it's not until, I believe, December. And so we have this breakdown of the ability to move up, the ability to have stable housing, to access quality healthcare, to access all of the things that go along with that, particularly for women who are single heads of households. There are longstanding consequences for this throughout our economy and throughout our communities.
Now, I understand that part of the gender pay gap is more pronounced in industries that are dominated by women. You see, or overall, you see industries where women are dominant have suppressed wages overall. So education, nursing, et cetera. Is that something that is consistent with what you've seen?
Yeah, so I think what we see is that there is a devaluing of care in our society, and that really hits women going and coming. So if you are the person in your family who's the primary caregiver, the fact that there is not access to affordable childcare or affordable elder care or help with a person in your family who might have disabilities, and that is going to fall particularly heavily on women who tend to be the primary caregivers and families for their family members. On the flip side of that, if you are a woman who works in those professions as a home health aide, as a child care worker, as a teacher, those are also professions that are not paid very well, again, because we just don't value that work and historically have not valued that work. And so what either side of the equation, you are going to be suffering from our inability to recognize how important that kind of care, those jobs are.
Is the pay in those industries low because we don't value the work and therefore women are the ones relegated to it? Or is it that the pay remains low because women are the ones dominating the industry? Is the sort of chicken or egg question there, or is that, or do those factors work together and it's hard to extricate them?
Well, I do think those factors work together. I also think that it's important to think of this in structural terms. So we had in the Build Back Better legislation that was proposed last year, there were plans in place, championed in particular by Senator Elizabeth Warren, that would both increase the pay of people in care professions, particularly when it comes to childcare and home health care, and also provide subsidies to support the families who need those kinds of services. That did not go through. And in fact, we're seeing in the budget fight that's going on right now, increasing threats to the programs that families, particularly families led by women, tend to rely on. And so it's not a matter of just sort of letting the market decide for this. If we really care about closing the wage gap and also providing quality care for our young people, for people with disabilities, and for our elderly, we need to make investments in those. And that means both investing in workers, investing in the number of services available in that workforce, and providing support for the families who need those services.
Now, the wage gap in geographically varies, and state by state, it depends on whether you live in a Republican-dominated state or a Democratic-dominated state, because it turns out that the wage gap is smaller in Democratic-leaning states, 83.6% is what women earn compared to men, compared to Republican-leaning states where women earn 79.4% of the wage that men do. Is that unsurprising to you, given that Republicans tend to be a lot more aggressive in ensuring, you know, investment in the kinds of things you were just saying?
Well, it's not a surprise, not just because of the difference in the politics of those states, but also if you look at the kinds of jobs that where the pay gap tends, or the industries where the pay gap tends to be largest, it's in those industries where there is a there's a requirement to work a specific set of hours, not a lot of flexibility, not a lot of worker power in those workplaces to determine the terms of their employment. And so you're going to find, for example, Republican states are more likely to be right-to-work states. And so having things like...
Meaning states that are unfriendly to unions.
Right, exactly. And so workers have less ability to push for things like predictable schedules or flexible schedules, less ability to have paid time off, and all of the different sort of flexible workplace terms that make it easier for women to press for all workers, but women in particular, to move up in the workplace.
Why has the gender wage gap persisted so stubbornly for two decades? I mean, you know, we've seen progress on women's rights fronts. We've seen regression when it comes to reproductive rights in particular. Mm-hmm. You would think that on the issue of wages, particularly as women are going to college in higher numbers than ever, they are assuming positions of leadership in greater numbers. There are more women representatives in Congress, not as many as there need to be, but still, compared to decades ago, there are more. Why has the wage gap, particularly over the last two decades, hardly moved?
Well, I think part of what you're seeing there is the limitation of individual solutions to this problem. So for a long time, there's been emphasis on things like coaching women to negotiate their salaries, or to, you know, sort of speak up in meetings, those kinds of things, being
the sort of personal responsibility approach to solving issues.
Right. And even where you have sort of protections against wage discrimination, that still requires someone to file a complaint, to file suit. It's something that is person by person, workplace by workplace. And I think what we're really seeing is that only gets you so far. And if we really want to close this gap, we really have to address these larger structural issues, including how we treat professions that have traditionally been associated with women, and what kind of flexibility and support we give to people who are caregivers.
So what are the non-individual solutions? What are the systemic solutions to closing the gender wage gap? And I imagine that they're intimately linked to making the economy fairer as a whole, for working people as a whole, because of course when women earn equal pay and have better working conditions, everybody does. And that holds even more true for women of color, for Black women, for Latina women, right?
Absolutely. And I think it's worth mentioning, we talk about the impact of caregiving largely falling to women on the pay gap. And, you know, it's worth pointing out that the children that they're caring for, the elderly parents, the disabled loved ones, we should care about those folks too. We should care about them having access to quality care, and them having all of the support that they need. And so this is not just the impact is on a wage gap for women, but the impact of us not valuing this work and not really emphasizing care work impacts all of us. So in terms of structural solutions, I would say, investing in affordable childcare, sort of on both sides of that equation. So raising the standards and incomes of childcare workers, and at the same time, providing support so families can still afford to access childcare. And same for home health aides and other kinds of support for caregiving that happens in the home. In addition to that, one of the most important things is just having flexible workplaces. We've seen post-pandemic the increase in sort of hybrid, where people are home a couple of times a week, or sort of split schedules where, you know, maybe you put in half of your workday in the morning and have a break for when the kids get home from school, and then you finish up later in the evening. Those kinds of policies also make it much easier for women to move up in the workplace, to have the same potential earnings throughout the course of their career as their male counterparts.
Tell me about CPD's Fed Up campaign and how that plays into discussions around the equal pay day.
Sure. So, well, I think there are a few things. I think so our Fed Up campaign, just to give some context on that, is a campaign that is targeting the Federal Reserve and really calling on them to be responsible for both sides of their dual mandate. So not just focus on inflation, but also focus on getting us to full employment. And historically, the Fed has really focused on inflation to the detriment of the labor force. And we see that happening right now as they raise interest rates. And you can see in reporting that the sort of yardstick they're using for determining success is the level of unemployment and the level of wage growth. And they're considering higher unemployment to be actually a good sign in terms of lowering inflation. And that's really exactly backwards. And part of the problem there is all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail thing. So the Federal Reserve is really focused on raising or lowering interest rates, which is a very blunt instrument. And again, what's needed if we really want to tackle inflation is to do something about corporate power. Corporations are able to raise prices when there aren't enough competitors in a market to push back against it. And we've allowed companies to consolidate, industries to become more concentrated, and corporations to have a lot of power over both their workers and their consumers. And so again, it's a problem of congressional action and Congress really abdicating its role in addressing inflation, which means the Federal Reserve is coming in with this very blunt and ultimately ineffective instrument.
Well, finally, Michelle, where can people find out more and get involved with the work that Center for Popular Democracy is doing, particularly on the issues of the economy?
Sure. So they can go to our website, which is populardemocracy.org. And we have a number of campaigns that folks can participate in terms of worker justice, access to healthcare, access to housing, and the full range of supports that are needed for working families.
And we link to that from our website as well. Michelle, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you.
My guest has been Michelle Kilpatrick, co-director of advocacy and mobilization at the Center for Popular Democracy. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUwithSonali. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Of the nearly 2 million people incarcerated in the United States at any given time, more than 500,000 are held in local jails. And a majority of those are being held before trial, which means they're innocent until proven guilty. The decision makers with most power to determine who's jailed and who isn't are local judges, usually elected, but often operating without much accountability. Now there's a growing effort toward judicial accountability led by the abolitionist organization La Defensa in Los Angeles. Joining me right now is its co-founder and executive director, Yvette Allais. Yvette describes themselves as a queer femme and formerly undocumented person who has been organizing and leading anti-carceral campaigns in California for nearly a decade. They have helped to found and lead multiple coalitions, including Justice LA and Reimagine LA, supporting historic victories such as ending LA County's $3.5 billion jail expansion plan in 2019 and passing Measure J in 2020. They previously served as policy director at Dignity and Power Now and was a statewide coordinator at Californians United for a Responsible Budget. Yvette's new op-ed at Yes Magazine is called Judging the Judges. And as the racial justice editor at Yes, I was their editor. Yvette, it's a pleasure to speak with you.
The pleasure is mine. Thank you so much for having me today.
So first, let's talk about the fact that there is this huge number of people, not just in LA, but around the country, that are jailed before they even begin trial. Generally, when somebody is arrested, before they are tried and they might get convicted or they might go free, it's up to a judge to decide whether or not they need to remain in jail and remain incarcerated or not. Why are there so many people who are jailed, and these are people who are considered innocent until proven guilty?
You know, that is a great question, Sonali. Like you shared, such a huge swath of the people incarcerated in our jails haven't been convicted yet. And there are two primary mechanisms in which people are detained. And one is the use of money bail. So a judge sets bail. They can either provide a bail amount that a person has to pay in order to buy their freedom, or they can just choose to preventatively detain someone. And so what that means is that the judge doesn't feel that that person will be returning to court for a future court date. And so those that have wealth are able to buy their freedom through the process of bail. And those that don't have wealth have to remain incarcerated for weeks, months, or even years until they have their day in court. And so the money bail process, we know, is inherently racist and classist. Those that have wealth, predominantly those that have generational wealth, that have access to wealth, often are folks with privilege, white folks, folks that have had that type of wealth. But when we talk about those most impacted by incarceration, predominantly communities of color, immigrant communities, folks without wealth, they remain incarcerated and can lose their jobs, lose custody of their children, lose their homes. So the ramifications of being incarcerated when you are legally innocent are vast. But there's another mechanism that I mentioned, preventative detention. And so a judge has the option to just say, you know what, I'm going to detain this person. I'm not going to set bail for them. And we saw that really come to rise in the 80s at the federal level with the Bail Reform Act of 1984, which really propelled the use of preventative detention. And so at the federal level, though you don't use money bail, the judge can decide, we're going to detain you. And what's often the motivator for a judge is that they don't want to be responsible if a person is released and then commits harm in the communities. From the judge's perspective, they don't want the person being rearrested for something or accused, and then their name, the judge's name, their face is splashed in the front of the New York Times or the LA Times as being responsible. But the fact of the matter is that the vast majority of people that are allowed to defend themselves from a position of freedom are actually able to successfully fight their cases. And so this fear that judges have and the power that they have to detain people without a conviction has really propelled the increases of our jail populations nationwide.
So there has been a bail reform movement, as you write about, and in California in particular, there was the passage of the Humphrey legal decision. Tell me about this and why it wasn't enough.
Yeah. So the basis of Humphrey is that courts and judges must consider someone's ability to pay when setting bail. So if someone, for example, is unemployed, if they are houseless, their ability to pay may very well be zero. And what we've seen in practice here in LA County, and I assume is also a practice that's happening not just here in our county, but across the state and across the country, is that judges will sometimes give bail of a dollar. And even that dollar is too much for someone that is unemployed and houseless to pay. And we've seen instances where the public defender that's assigned to their case will, you know, try to pay that dollar bail. That is so indicative of the way that the judicial system works. It will set bail at completely unaffordable rates, even though Humphrey says that bail must be set at affordable rates. Judges are not applying Humphrey. In fact, they are completely practicing illegal acts in the courtroom by not applying Humphrey. And there's currently a lawsuit. The Civil Rights Court has sued LA County and the LA Superior Court for not implementing Humphrey. So we could see laws being passed, but by and large, judges are unaccountable. There are very little mechanisms to hold judges accountable. You know, you mentioned at the top that judges can be elected, but most people don't know that judges can be elected or are not informed about judicial elections or who these candidates are. So the one mechanism that we have, or one of the very few mechanisms that we have, which are elections, are insufficient at the moment because people don't know about them and people are not informed about what happens in the courtroom.
Right.
And so what we see is that judges can basically act independently.
And that becomes oftentimes the part of one's ballot that that people tend to leave blank, or they scramble last minute. They try to dig around online to see if they can find any information, because judges don't get that much media attention. They might have a very simple campaign website, but that's their version of what they want the world to know. And it's usually platitudes or generalities. And so then let's talk about the tool that your organization, La Defensa, created to give people who are voters a chance at getting some accurate information on judges, and also just apply pressure in general to judges. You liken it in your article for Yes as a Yelp for judges. Tell me about this review tool.
Yes, it's called Rate My Judge. And like you mentioned, it's like a Yelp for judges. So we rely on community reviews from folks that go into the courtroom that either have their day in court or are a family member of someone that's going inside. Also public defenders, court interpreters, whoever's in the courtroom is able to go onto our website and leave a review for a judge and judge them on everything from how much they followed the law to their decorum, whether they were fair. And these reviews help paint a picture about how a judge is behaving in the courtroom. We're actually expanding the site with our upcoming Court Watch program to really integrate additional data around the implementation of the Humphrey decision, for example, to make sure that we provide voters and the community with a full picture on judicial behavior. And this full picture helps inform what judges folks want to vote for. If a judge goes to Harvard or prestigious school, that doesn't give me information around how they're treating my community, which is basically a lot of the information that we are able to find on judges is, you know, where they used to practice law. The vast majority of judges are former district attorneys. And so they're former prosecutors that are on the bench, that come from a prosecutorial background and have a lens of conviction, which is really a motivator for prosecutors, is how many folks that they can convict. And so That's the culture of the bench. It comes from a law enforcement background. But when we're able to diversify the bench, when we're able to make judicial races competitive, when we're having diversity on the bench, more women, more people of color, more folks from a public defense background, then we're able to really shift the ways and the approach of the bench and how they're actually treating our community members, in addition to exposing them through our Rate My Judge tool.
And we'll get very shortly to one of those new people that has just been elected. But going back to the Rate My Judge tool, is it primarily people who have personally had experience with the judge that they might be rating, maybe, you know, being the person under trial, or is it family members or, you know, part of the friend social network of the person who's come there to do community support, or all of the above?
It's all of the above. So our site is completely anonymous. So part of the protections for individuals, especially if they're in current cases that are ongoing, we want to make sure to protect their anonymity. So all of our reviews are anonymous, but the reviews reflect folks that engage with the courts. And so we'll see reviews from public defenders who are in the courts day in, day out. We have reviews from community members who are facing charges or from their loved ones. We have reviews from court interpreters that are in the court and watching the behavior of judges. And so we have eyes and ears through all vehicles and all community members that are in the courtroom. And with our new court watch program that we're integrating, we'll be able to include other community members that are able to just sit and observe and gather more information.
So that's firsthand knowledge of how the judges behave in the courtroom. And that website, by the way, is ratemyjudge.la. So if you're watching or listening, if you've ever been, if you've ever had an experience in an LA courtroom and want to speak out either about a judge you thought was incredibly unfair or one that was imminently fair, people can go and rate that judge if they're still actually operating. So let's talk about how we need to change the face of the judiciary itself. You write in your story for Yes Magazine about Holly Hancock, and who started out as a public defender and who has now been elected to LA County Superior Court. I wasn't aware that public defenders very rarely actually make it into those positions. Tell me about Hancock.
Yeah, so Holly Hancock was part of the Defenders of Justice. So in 2022, La Defensa launched a PAC. So we knew we didn't just want to expose judges. We wanted to help transform the judiciary and insert folks that have experience in public defense, in civil rights, to actually take to the bench. And we created a coalition, the Transforming the Judiciary Coalition, with other partners to help identify who could be a good candidate, who would be willing to take the risk, who has alignment in values and could support alternatives to incarceration and diversion, rather than just leaning into a prosecutorial approach to the bench. And through that process, we identified four amazing candidates, one of which was Holly Hancock, who had a deep history of support from the community. She had actually run before. She had run before in the last cycle, but lost. And what we wanted to do in this last cycle, was create a community of support so that those that are running for the bench don't have to do it alone, and that they know that the community can be behind them. And that was the Defenders of Justice, four amazing women that were either civil rights attorneys or public defenders that ran for office. And Holly Hancock, with her experience, having run before, with her experience as a successful public defender, defending our community members, really rose to the top and won her election. And we're incredibly proud of her. She is the first Black woman public defender to ever be elected to the LA Superior Court, which is historic.
So now we are at this position where you've made some headway via your organization, La Defensa, to rate the judges, to run judges. You mentioned those courtroom watch as well that you're integrating. Do you see this as part of an abolitionist approach to criminal justice in general? And if so, how? Because your organization, La Defensa, identifies as an abolitionist organization.
Yeah, that's a great question. And so for us, abolition is not just abolishing brick and mortar homes of incarceration, like jails and prisons. Abolition is not just law enforcement cops, but law enforcement takes many forms. It takes the form of probation officers that surveil our communities. It takes the form of district attorneys, which prosecute our communities. And it takes the form of judges who ultimately convict and incarcerate our community members. And so for us, judicial accountability is part of our steps to abolition, because we're exposing the behavior of judges and exposing them as an actor in the prison industrial complex, an actor that doesn't get a lot of attention and that is actually one of the most unaccountable actors within the system, because they act as a separate branch of government, have the ability to incarcerate our folks with impunity, are not even following the law when we're talking about the issue of pretrial incarceration in Humphrey, for example. And so we wanted to expose. That's one step. We also wanted to do harm reduction. And harm reduction is being able to replace judges and take seats that would otherwise be held by those that were former prosecutors. We wanted to insert more diversity, but not just diversity in terms of gender and race diversity. We want to include diversity of legal background, because diversity of legal background helps shift the culture as well as other forms of diversity, but is actually more of an indicator of alignment with our values. So for example, if we have a Latina woman who's a former prosecutor, she may include more diversity in the bench, but that doesn't necessarily shift the needle in terms of how often our community members are prosecuted and convicted. And so in order to have real transformation, we need to have diversity of thought and diversity of legal background. And it's a harm reduction measure. Ultimately, the judiciary is not the right vehicle for accountability. We cannot depend on a single person to be deciding whether our community members should be incarcerated when they haven't been convicted. It is incredibly powerful that we have given up our power to judges for so long, and now we're taking steps to take back that power. Part of the road to stripping the judiciary of power is also legal action, like we're seeing with civil rights court enforcing the courts to apply Humphrey. It's policy changes to strip the judiciary of power. That's all towards abolition, stripping the system of power and diverting resources to what should be our vehicles of accountability, which are community-based models of accountability that actually take someone's needs into consideration, someone's strengths into consideration, in order to address the root causes of harm, rather than just putting a Band-Aid on the problem and shutting someone in a jail cell.
Well, Yvette, thank you so much for joining us. Give out a website for La Defensa.
Yes, ladefensa.org. Please visit us, and you can check us out on social media at La Defensa X on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.
And we'll post links to those from our website again. Thank you so much, Yvette. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, Sonali.
Yvette Ale is co-founder and executive director of La Defensa and wrote the new op-ed Judging the Judges at Yes Magazine. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. We'll be right back. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. The United States' technology industry is considered the driving force of the national and even global economy. Tech workers, however, suffer from many of the same problems seen in other parts of the economy: stratification along racial and gender lines, low pay and long hours, and job insecurity. A new book called What We Build with Power: The Fight for Economic Justice in Tech offers a manifesto on worker-led organizing, particularly in communities of color. My guest is David Delmar Sentias, activist and organizer who founded the nonprofit organization Resilient Coders, a coding boot camp that trains people of color from low-income backgrounds for high-growth careers as software engineers. His book's full title is called What We Build with Power: The Fight for Economic Justice in Tech. Welcome to the program, David.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
So first, tell me how severe the problem is of, in particular, racial representation in tech, not just representation as a whole, but how, as I mentioned, it's stratified within the industry, with lower paid positions largely going to, or people of color largely being given lower paid positions and not being very represented in the higher paying jobs within the industry.
Yeah, we have a workforce development ecosystem that for the last several decades has focused on just getting people into jobs. And there hasn't really been a lot of conversation about power. Like, what are the actual opportunities? What is the actual landscape of power that people are entering? And so what that means is that it's been largely driven by the needs of the employer, which is to say that the employer is going to want to hire talent in a way that is affordable, with minimizing any sort of commitments for job security or career growth or any of that. And so what ends up happening is that you have a lot of folks who are getting into the space from workforce development and entering into low-paying jobs that don't really have a lot of opportunity for growth. And that may be jobs, but that's not power. And so I think it's time that we shift our focus from getting somebody a job to getting somebody into a position of power.
How serious is the situation? Can you give us some figures so we can get a sense of what the industry looks like?
Yeah, I haven't really found figures that are really like, there are numbers out there that generally speaking, Black folks are, I think, 4% of the tech workforce. Latino, Latina, Latinx people tend to be about 2% of the tech workforce. But those are very broad numbers. I've never seen anything that segments it down to or correlates it with salaries, right? That's just tech, broadly speaking. Here in Boston, where we are based, there is a very stark difference between the jobs that most people of color are entering into through workforce development and the types of jobs that can allow people to live in their own cities.
So tell me about how you got into doing this work. Tell me about Resilient Coders and the work with this nonprofit that then built helped you build your ideas for this book that you've written.
The purpose of Resilient Coders is economic justice. And it started about economic justice in Boston. Boston has particularly severe wealth disparities. I believe that we are the most unequal city in the union by wealth distribution. The median household net worth of a white family in this region is $245,000. The median household net worth of a Black family in this region is $8. Not $8,000, $8.
Wow.
And for Dominicanos, it is $0. And what that means is that, generally speaking, Black and Latinx folks here in this town have about as much debt as they have in assets. And as you can see, it's deeply racialized in this town. And it is going to get worse. I like to tell people that, like, here on my street, right, I live on a street that is lined with cars that have Lyft and Uber stickers on the windshields. Right? Those jobs are going to be automated very soon. What happens to my entire neighborhood when that happens? What happens when the jobs that my neighbors depend on disappear? And there is no broad systemic effort to retrain people for other jobs, because we have chosen to spin up a high growth industry that is predicated on expensive college, which is inaccessible to most Americans.
And are people of color in the tech industry largely in positions that are prone to future automation?
Oh, absolutely. I think a lot of the folks that are in tech right now are, they either have skills that are very proprietary that essentially lock them into a particular job, right? Like that. So that company might have its own proprietary coding language or framework, such that if that's the skill that you have, it's going to be very hard for you to move to a different job. Or they have jobs like help desk, like IT help desk jobs that are going away immediately, or they're being offshored. And so those folks who are, a lot of the folks who are in tech, like working quote unquote tech jobs, are immediately vulnerable to automation.
So let's start with where you also start with, which is college and university, and the reason why you started Resilient Coders. How is it, or why is it, that the tech industry tends to recruit primarily from elite, very expensive Ivy League universities and colleges, which suggests that right from the beginning of the recruitment process, when people enter the industry, they're selecting away from people of color. Their selection process undermines people of color and lower income folks.
Yes. So this is a conversation that I have had over and over again with different prospective employers here in my town. And what a lot of folks say is, well, we just need people who have those degrees. And this is the land of Harvard, MIT, BU, BC, Tufts, Northeastern. And so people are used to this pipeline of, you know, white kids coming in from out of town, going through these elite colleges, setting up, you know, roots here in Boston. And then that's their pipeline, which essentially just like bypasses Bostonians. And what they say is, well, they, you know, to work here, they really just need that education from college. They do not, because a lot of folks, like, you don't really learn how to program in these,
right,
in these universities.
I mean,
what you learn is computer science,
and coding languages change all the time. I mean, by the
exactly.
time you graduate, the thing you learned in your first year of college has either had a new version put out, or there's an entirely different coding language altogether.
That's exactly it. I tell people that if you want your car to be fixed by a mechanic who can explain the physics of combustion to you, that's cool. You're just going to have a really hard time finding a mechanic, and you're just going to pay a lot of money for that one mechanic that you find. But you don't really need that person to be able to explain the physics of combustion. You just need that person to be good at their trade, their craft. That's the same thing with programmers. This whole thing only makes sense if you look at it from the perspective of a phenomenon called opportunity hoarding. So here's opportunity hoarding in a nutshell. Access to good jobs. Access to good jobs is a valuable resource because it leads to wealth. And so if you see access to jobs as a resource, right, restricting access to the resource drives value for the people who do have access to that resource. Mm. Do you know what I mean? And so
yeah.
the fact that there's a lot of money to be had there makes those who have access to that pathway want to hold on tight to it. Set up velvet ropes so that there is a line separating those who can get in and those who cannot get in, right? If you have the privilege of sending your kid to Harvard and paying for that education in Harvard, you're going to want Harvard to remain an exclusive university, right? You wouldn't want Harvard to announce that suddenly they're going to accept anybody. There's a certain degree of exclusivity there that is rampant in higher education and quote unquote elite institutions, and specifically in tech. And so that is a big driver behind what drives inequality nationally. Now, here in Boston, here in my town, US-born Latinx people such as myself and Black folks happen to coincide on a 28% graduation rate from college. 28%. So 28% of US-born Latinx people and Black people in Boston have a college degree, right? And so what I tell these companies that I speak to is, listen, you're out here talking about DEI. Like, you're out here talking about trying to bring more people of color into your industry. And you are, by virtue of the fact that you require a BA to perform this work that does not require a BA to perform, eliminating from consideration like 72% of people of color in this town. We need to do something about that BA requirement.
I mean, even if there was a BA requirement, but people were being hired from community colleges or state schools, we'd probably have a better situation than we do now. But you're saying you don't even really need a college degree to learn how to code?
Absolutely. I mean, I agree with everything that you said. It would be great if tech companies out here would also hire from state schools, local universities. But you don't even really need a college degree to do this work. You can learn it. You can absolutely learn how to program on the job.
Because of your work with Resilient Coders.
That's exactly right. Resilient Coders is basically a statement. It is a statement that you do not need to go to college to learn this trade. It is a trade, and we need to treat it as a trade. And trades are, you have a sponsor, you have a training program, you bring people in, you pay them to learn. At Resilient Coders, we insist on paying everybody to learn, because otherwise you're sourcing candidates from a pool of people who can afford to just not work for a period of time. Look, that's what they do in the trades. That's the future. I feel like tech believes itself to be somehow progressive and far ahead of these other industries that are quote unquote older. But the trades have it figured out in a way that tech hasn't gotten to quite yet in terms of bringing talent.
So tell me more about Resilient Coders. So you work primarily with young people of color, training them on how to code. Do they ever, are these folks who have experience with coding or have taken a computer science class? What's the starting point with which they begin, and what's your success rate in getting them, out on the other end as fully trained coders?
So the folks who are coming into the program are, they don't have any experience in tech by and large. Most of them don't have a college degree. And they're young. When I say young, I mean early career. They're between 18 and 30. And they're all people of color and all from economically precarious circumstances and backgrounds. And we bring them into the program without testing them. We'd never do any sort of testing at Resilient Coders. We bring them in, we train them for 5 months, we pay them. Every other week, they get $1,000. Right? So we pay them to learn.
So you pay them $1,000 a week?
Every other week.
Every other week. So they earn basically almost about $2,000 a month.
That's right.
Incredible.
They need to be able to live in their city while they learn. Otherwise, people need jobs. And so they spend their time learning. I will say a good chunk of people drop off, where the program is very, very, very hard, and we're unapologetic about that. And so we lose a few folks along the way. And those who graduate, historically, we've been able to connect upwards of 85%+ of them into jobs. And our average starting salary for the last couple of years has been around $95,000 a year. And that's folks without a background in tech. You can absolutely learn this. And then they go to their jobs and they do well the job, and they, as software engineers, have more of an opportunity to continue a trajectory than some other tech jobs.
Now, the field of computer science and programming is one where, given the right kind of training, you are basically somebody who learns how to learn, right? Because
yes,
it's an evolving field, because it's one where languages change as technology changes, as needs change. There are new computer programming languages that are developed. And so you have to be nimble. You have to be able to learn on the fly. You have to be able to teach yourself new languages as they come along. So I imagine that's the main skill that people are expected to know when they enter the industry that I imagine you're teaching at Resilient Coders.
Learning how to learn.
It doesn't matter if you go to Harvard to get.
I tell our students, look, I made it to my 30s before learning how I learn. Mm. Isn't that wild? Can you imagine an education system? I mean, I can sit here and tell you, random facts that I learned, but I didn't learn how I learn until I was in my 30s. And so we focus a lot of attention on making sure that people have an opportunity to discover how it is that they learned how to learn. And we tell them right out the gate, the stuff that we're teaching you is going to be obsolete in a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
this isn't your grandfather's trade, where you learn a thing and then you do it for 50 years. You really need to continue refreshing your skills. And so if you do this work, you are committing to a lifetime of continued learning, which is for some people and it's not for others.
And it can be very exciting too, right?
Absolutely.
I mean,
yeah.
How do you feel that it's not just that recruiters for these industries with lucrative jobs are deliberately, in a way, leaving out people of color, but do you also feel that the schools, particularly public education and K-12 schooling, fails kids of color in learning the skills necessary?
You know, I actually don't know that it comes down to education. I think our schools are actually doing, at least out here in Boston, the ones that I'm familiar with, right? I'll keep my opinions to the domain that I know, right? Here in Boston, in the schools that I'm familiar with, they actually do a really good job of introducing kids to, programming principles, like the logic behind it, when they're pretty young, and just getting kids excited about it and getting kids to see themselves succeeding in this field. And you mentioned the recruiters that are excluding people of color, and for sure that happens. But I also want to lift people's eyes up from just interpersonal racism, because while of course interpersonal racism is a factor, it is not the only factor. And as long as we focus on that as the exclusive factor, we will be missing the point. There are systemic barriers that transcend any one people or group of people in tech, in terms of making it a difficult place for people of color to enter and succeed. Let me give you an example. I always tell people, now this town is filled with startup companies, right? And we went and spoke to a startup a few years ago, and we said, here's our pitch, blah, 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 hire from a zillion coders, this, that, and the other thing. And they said, oh no, we need people that can just hit the ground running right away and just be at, be contributing to our code base like on day one. Right, which our coders could do that, but we like to give people a ramp up, right, to get used to the work before they're dragged along by the hair. And we kind of were like, well, why is that? Let's unpack that. And here's the thing. They have VC money, right? So they have VC money, and their value proposition back to the VC, back to their investors, is we don't have particularly interesting technology. What we can do is get to market and get to a critical mass of users more quickly than our competitors can. And so when they hire people, when they hire a tech team, right, the CTO is like, all right, cool, we can have this built for you in a year. The CEO is like, make it 3 months, right? And so what happens is the CTO has to be like, all right, who can we hire that can just code really quickly with no on-ramp and no training? And so the CTO is like, I quote unquote don't have time to think about DEI. I'm going to hire my roommates from MIT, and they're going to hire their friends who they played in a band with, and they're going to, you know what I mean? And so they basically just like fill those technical teams with people who are just like them because of this concern to deliver code quickly.
So it becomes a white boys network?
It becomes a white boys network, and it's not just because of interpersonal racism. It is because people don't have the chance to enter because systemically startups need to be showing, they have a fiduciary responsibility to their investors to show returns very, very quickly. And their value proposition is speed, not technology. Anyone who wants to learn more about resilient coders, we're at resilientcoders.org. And currently we're in Boston and Philly. And by the way, I am no longer the executive director there. I have stepped down, but I'm on the board, and I'm close with the team over there, and we're still doing awesome work.
David, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and best of luck to you.
Thank you so much. It was awesome being here. Thank you for having me on.
My guest is David Delmar-Santillas, activist and organizer who founded the nonprofit organization Resilient Coders. And we've been discussing his new book called What We Build With Power, The Fight for Economic Justice in Tech. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band, Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RUWithSonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RUWithSonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
We're the fifth graders from David Douglas Tag Center. We listen to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.